You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I introduce to you once again, live from Mudgee, New South Wales, Dr. Val Webb. Let's hear it.
Good. Well, I survived the sermon without too many coughings, but I still have all the equipment here. David told me I had about an hour and a half. Okay, there's your sermon. Okay. I know it's called Q&A, but I do plan to do a presentation for about 25 minutes or so, and to give us some things that will start us off. And I'll get back a bit so I don't have to twist my neck too far to see you all. That's good. This is called Midwives of Change, Shaping Theologically Hospitable Communities, when we have a variety of theologies in the one community. Last year, the Progressives, as David said, in Australia, held their third national conference on the theme Midwives of Change. And might I add that a bunch of guys on a committee chose the title. So, well, there we are. In my preparation, I came across this wonderful quote from the Chinese sacred text, the Tao Te Ching, or the Way, which was written 6 centuries before Jesus also wrote about a way. The quote says, "You are a midwife, assisting at somebody else's birth. Do good without show or fuss. Facilitate what's happening rather than what you think ought to be happening. If you have to take the lead, lead so that the mother is helped, yet still free and in charge. When the baby is born, the mother then can rightly say, 'We did it ourselves.'" These words are great advice, I think, for progressive communities that are emerging in the 21st century. You are the midwife, assisting at somebody else's birth. This is not about our own convictions or certainties. Midwives neither give birth or are what is birthed. We're merely assistants of change. Do good without show or fuss. Facilitate what's happening rather than what you think ought to be happening. I love that one. The midwife's task is to help the mother and child do what they need to do according to their natural instinct and their own experiences. If you must take the lead, it says, lead so that the mother is helped and yet still free and in charge. We're to assist at somebody else's transformation without trying to control the final result. And the goal is, when the baby is born, the mother will rightly say, "We did it ourselves." Recently, someone said in a presentation like this, "We have failed our children because they're not in church any longer." Sound familiar? But a young person, after a lot of oohs and ahs and sad faces, a young person in the back stood up and said, "You didn't fail us. You gave us what we needed, a hospitable place and permission to think for ourselves. And we did." This is the role of midwives. Last Thursday night, I talked about the importance of celebrating doubt in our communities. David Felton and Jeff Proctor Murphy, with their Living the Questions, has made this happen for many people around the world, I must tell you. Living the Questions is a highlight in England and in Australia and New Zealand and in churches. It has allowed people to see doubt not as a negative, but as the discrepancy between when belief systems, what you're told to believe, doesn't line up with your own experience or knowledge or training. As midwives of change, we have to build communities of theological hospitality that can encourage doubt, allow conflicting beliefs to exist together, and celebrate the variety of faith experiences that emerge without tearing each other apart or forcing everyone to conform. It's no secret that there's never been only one way of understanding God or Jesus or Jesus' implications for Christianity. When I looked up the word theology in one of my reference books, which usually means talking about God, there were 19 entries. Different adjectives: dogmatic theology, empirical theology, feminist, historical, liberation, natural, process, womanist, just to name a few. But it goes on and on. Now, many laity won't know the existence of or even the difference between these terms and probably don't care. And this is not a judgment about lay intelligence, but about the exclusivity of our technological, theological language, meaningful only in a small group of people. I have seen highly literate professionals in their own field reduced to comic book level by ministers who will erect a barricade of theological language against any lay challenge. And I've seen pastors who make speech adjustments when talking to lay people, like we do when talking to children. These are cases of theological inhospitality. When church communities such as this one encourage people to move beyond traditional ideas and claim their own autonomy in matters of faith and belief, there can be a rich diversity of ideas snuggling under the one blanket. The opposite of autonomy is a passive surrender of our authority to some external rule, whether it's scripture, tradition, clergy, family, and this is something we've done for centuries in the church. Many of us who grew up surrendering our autonomy or leaving our brains at the door can remember that first thrill of discovery when we suddenly realised that somebody else had the same questions as us and that theologians who had studied all this in depth also had those questions. The journey from this point is rarely a sudden "once I was blind but now I see" journey, but rather a long pregnancy of chipping away the layers of truth with recurring moments of uncertainty and fear as to what we once treasured is being lost or discarded. Such a process needs gentle midwifery. However, once such exploration begins beyond the tradition, something like the Tour de France can happen. Some people burst from the starting block with enthusiasm to throw off anything and everything that gives them trouble in the doctrines. Caution is swept away as they pedal off, not even looking to see if anyone is following. Such people have often been struggling internally with their doubts for ages and just needed this space to be able to have permission to speak. And many of these are theologically trained folk who may not have spoken out within their institutions. In this new space, they forge ahead, sometimes dragging other members along with them and unconsciously maybe scorning those who can't keep up. It's the "you don't still think that" syndrome. Rather than being midwives, some will presume to work it out for all the others. And this can become the new orthodoxy, which is again not theological hospitality. We need to be careful in our communities, our progressive communities, that those taking the first scary steps out of the traditional box are not stunned or obliterated by more powerful voices wanting everyone to jump forward to some definitive end. We need to think carefully about what sort of a hospitable community we want to be. As I move around progressive churches in many countries, I've detected some of this. While most people have moved away from ideas of the bearded God seated on the cloud, directing the world from outside, some will talk of mystery, presence, spirit, while some don't talk of a God at all, rather feel they can work out their own path by simply responding to the world with justice and kindness. I've actually found it a minefield to speak in some progressive groups, which have established high walls of correctness about what language and imagery we can and cannot use about the sacred. I'll share my cards. As a scientist in the past, I personally find it overconfident in light of the ever-expanding knowledge of our universe and the assurance from scientists that we haven't seen anything yet. I think it's overconfident to make definitive claims about what does not exist rather than living open to the ever-changing mystery. It actually doesn't help hurt us to do that, to live openly as we do in every other part of life. Scientist Carl Sagan said, "The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." Although we might rightly celebrate this diversity, I struggle with issues of hospitality when some positions are championed as what all progressives should think, closing the conversation rather than opening it up. The question for progressive midwives is, are we trying to give birth to something with some continuity with our past DNA, or are we simply creating a baby from contemporary dust mixed with water that could equally have a heritage in AA, Rotary, or the Baha'i faith? Professor Paul Nitter from Union Theological Seminary says in his wonderful book called Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian, "All good theology is a matter of discontinuity in continuity. Creating something new that is rooted in and nourished by the old." Australian sociologist Gary Bomer defines social cohesion as the capability of a group to so organise its resources and its people to produce what it needs to sustain and reproduce itself. Progressive churches have to find ways to maintain our social cohesion without denying people the freedom to hold beliefs important to themselves. We need ways to say who we are and what we think, to acknowledge our need for each other, yet gently confront those who insist on one correct stance, wherever it be on the continuum. Professor Diana Eck from Harvard, who is an expert in Hindu studies and also a United Methodist, when she's asked how she holds both religious traditions together, she says, "I define myself not by my religious borders, but by who I am at the centre, a seeker after the sacred." Being midwives of change is not about getting the theology right. We can read about the historical Jesus research until we're blue in the face, but our resource material for life is not just what's in the Bible and the questions that come out of it. If we believe that the divine is not off somewhere in heaven, but present within us and all creation, everything in our universe becomes a midwife for us in our search for human transformation. Science, more than anything, has encouraged us to ponder our lives on a much bigger drawing board by showing us a universe far greater and mysterious than the universe of religion, the cosmos of our creeds, or the heaven of golden streets in the clouds. This amazing glimpse into mystery and wonder pushes us to imagine a sacred large enough to contain such grandeur, or else to reimagine our religious claims altogether. Science also offers hints as how to assess our claims. Science is not about immutable laws, but about provisional explanations, open to revision when better information comes along. We need to heed the challenges of science as a midwife, not just as a sub-theme to religion, but as a stunning midwife in its own right that must inform all our religious deliberations. And what about those atheist midwives who work to create space for challenging the established truth? Sam Harris said at the Global Atheism Convention in Australia, "Atheism in itself has nothing to offer. Science, art, and philosophy do. Atheism merely provides a space for the conversation." The rise of new atheists has become a wake-up call with their public discussion of many of our questions, and they invite us to engage in exploration beyond our religious borders. New atheism gives us the ability to step into their arguments as a place from which we can then reevaluate our old truths. Even politics is a midwife of change, discouraging as it may be, both in Australia and in this country. If our goal is to reflect theologically in the context and circumstances in which we live, politics is a public discourse where many midwives meet to help birth changes in the world, whether it's ethics, economics, social justice, global action. Literature, poetry, art, and music are also midwives, whether they have religious content or not. I'm constantly amazed at how novels and biographies call me to theological reflection through the inspiring lives of both real people and fictional characters. I have notebooks of quotes from novels that offer more life skills to me than many theological tomes. Apparently, 75,000 Australians put Jedi Knight, or some related Star Wars term, in the Australian census question about what their religion was. When some religious folk expressed offence, Gary Bomer said, "Have you seen one of their movies? You get three sermons. The injunction to trust the Force, the blessing may the Force be with you, a well-developed moral frame, a theological orientation, and a basis of hope, all packed up in some whiz-bang kind of visual stuff." Pretty impressive and rather more engaging than the average sermon or Sunday school platitude. After centuries of church resistance to natural theology, we are again reading from its leafy pages. Now, natural theology argues that we can have knowledge of the sacred through the universe and in human nature. We can interpret or talk about the sacred or experience the sacred within the world and the universe. The long-time traditional argument in the church against natural theology hinged on the fear that if God could be known in nature, why do we need the revelation of Jesus? Theologian Sally McFaig, who was raised in this anti-natural theology tradition, where she says, "Only the word that reached my ears conveyed the presence of God, never the sights before my eyes," became a champion of natural theology, reminding us that any theological constructions are simply, as she says, houses to live in for a while, with windows open and doors ajar. They become prisons when they no longer allow us to come and go, to add a room or to take one away, or if necessary, to move out and build another house. Reimagining of divine creativity within the universe and nature has both returned permission and, in fact, justified theologically our need to see the planet as something sacred. When people ask me, "What do we teach our grandchildren?" I say, "What about midwifing them into the passionate love of nature that can in turn midwife them into an experience of what they might call the sacred? Tell the grandchildren the history of the world, not through wars and human inventions, but through stories of the great book of nature, of rivers, of forests, of insects and trees. Stop feeling guilty about which Bible story or which religious doctrine we should teach them and which one to avoid. Anchor them deeply in this earth and let their wonder and awe lead to deeper reflection with you as the midwife rather than a religious instructor with a bundle of information to hand on." As Australian biblical scholar Norman Harbell says, we need to live as earth beings in solidarity with earth, not God-like beings who happen just to be sojourners on the earth. Interreligious dialogue is another midwife for transformation. If human beings are on a similar quest, albeit in different contexts, surely religions formed from other quests have something to offer. Must we always be so arrogant as to reinvent the wheel? Can't we walk in somebody else's religious moccasins and help us understand, that would help us understand and fit into our own? If we speak of the sacred within everything, or God in whom we live and move and have our being, as Paul said, that necessarily means that this divine presence in this planet is also in the Hindu, Muslim, atheist, and Sikh, which brings Christianity to a whole new imaginative place. We can no longer describe the sacred only from within our cultural and religious imagination. Can we talk about Jesus as the only incarnation if we have never investigated how other religions describe the sacred incarnated in them? Can we adjudicate across religions as to who has the correct words and who performs the correct rituals? If the sacred is in everything, we need to see for authenticity and completeness how what we describe as God appears in different religious shapes. What begins as interfaith conversation becomes a personal search within other religious explanations. By now you realise this lecture could go on and on as my searchlight scans inexhaustible midwives of change that impact us in our life at every moment. Everything is a midwife to be fully human, not just the narrow limits of certain scholarship. In every changing moment, we're bombarded by a plethora of influences, emotional, informational, psychological, physical, all of which influence what we'll be in our next moment. In this bombardment is also what we will see as the sacred. We need to acknowledge this diversity of splendid import and pay attention to it all. As Professor Philip Clayton says, on the one hand, theology is a never-ending quest. It calls one continually to respond to novel ways, to new horizons of interpretation, whether they come from science, philosophy, culture, or society. On the other hand, theology hearkens continually back to its past, its scripture, classic figures, traditional themes, or loci, in the ongoing process of retrieval and renewal. With all these resources to build hospitable communities, what glue will bind us together? Something in common that takes precedence over variations. I believe the unifying factor for hospitality is Jesus' command to love. Or in other words, have compassion. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. It's about relationships rather than creeds. When I ask churches of theological diversity what holds them together, this is their answer: mutual respect. Somebody said recently of an 85-year-old lay preacher with a radical but thoughtful theology, "We don't agree with him, but he knows we love him." Doctrinal interpretations come and go, splitting families, communities, and individuals apart. Belief systems rise and fall, causing wars and racial tensions. Religious leaders claim exclusive revelation and then crumble with feet of clay. Scripture is used and misused as a weapon at the whim and base and idea of any group or individual. What will hold us together is a community of love. Most families that stay together through thick and thin seem to be able to say, "I'm sorry and I love you," even when the most unlovable things happen. The church family should be able to do that as well. It's interesting that Jesus preached relationship rather than dogma. And love as a relationship can never be theologically systematized, but only described in the different particularities of thousands of experiences we call love. This is not to say that conservative communities are not loving, but their hospitality always plays, their love always plays second fiddle to doctrinal conformity. On the other hand, if a community allows their experience of loving God and their neighbour to shape their theological reflection, doctrinal uniformity becomes second, third, or even fourth to the hospitality of creating space for people on their journey. So as midwives of change, what does compassionate theological hospitality look like? Firstly, it demands we respect each other. Respect is a central human desire, according to Australian commentator Hugh Mackay. Respect means taking others seriously, not overlooking or belittling them. It means taking their beliefs seriously rather than trying to impose our own. It's about true listening, telling me you care about what I think. Not really listening or feeling with means that you don't hear what I'm saying and signals that I'm not worth listening to. Compassionate hospitality means listening not for an opening to argue, teach, correct, or leave, but with genuine hunger to learn from each other. When we do talk, compassion doesn't judge and manipulate, but invites further revelations. We're not listening hospitably if we listen through the filter of our own particular beliefs and agenda. At a retreat once, somebody cornered me after my talk, said, "Do you believe in the virgin birth?" When I began to dissect various ideas around this, he interrupted me and said, "No, do you believe in the virgin birth?" He wanted a yes or no answer. If I'd said no, he could simply dismiss everything I had said that day. If I said yes, there would be no need to listen any further because we agreed, or I agreed, on his position. According to Hugh Mackay, listening is a form of therapy that we offer each other if we choose to. In fact, he says, if I had to identify one way to make the world a better place, I'd say, listen more attentively and sympathetically to each other. And hospitable listening leads to compassionate speaking. When someone said something mean to us as children in Australia, and perhaps here as well, we chanted one of our earliest received lies. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. You may have said this too. Of course words hurt. Some people carry the hurt of verbal abuse till their deathbed. Do unto others means speak to others as you would have others speak to you. Bullying is blossoming today. With the ability of social media to trash others without eye contact or physical presence, leading to tragic suicides. Today's media operates in sound bites and shock journalism to incite controversy rather than nuanced arguments and fair presentation of the ideas. Muslim colleagues tell me that their moderate articles about Islam, which they have submitted to Australian newspapers, are never published, and that they are overlooked in media interviews in preference of those who will make provocative or fanatical claims. When hospitality is central to communities rather than doctrinal uniformity, we get new metaphors for church. And the one I like is a scientific conference, where everyone comes to announce their, not just their great discoveries, but their slow progress. One paper may show a drug hasn't worked for years after testing, and another may solve a piece in a bigger puzzle. Another will admit no progress at all. There's no fear of reporting failure or lack of progress, because even that's useful. Names aren't struck off registers, ridiculed or shamed because they haven't yet solved their puzzle. Colleagues learn from each other's experience and offer feedback, and new areas come to be researched. Scientific theories, like religious doctrines, are not eternal truths, but frameworks of agreed understanding, open to challenge and correction should they become inadequate. And so it should be in our churches. Part of theological hospitality is to acknowledge theological options from the pulpit. According to some church wisdom, sermons should be inspiring and not teaching. I disagree. We bemoan illiteracy and lack of inquisitiveness in our laity, yet over 90% of laity only go to church services and never go to the small groups. If preachers cannot make biblical criticism and theology engaging to thinking people from the pulpit, they need to learn some new tricks. Laity around the world have responded so well to Living the Questions because it offers challenging thoughts to intelligent laypeople rather than bland milk. In an article recently on understanding atheism in an Australian journal, a Scottish theologian suggests that new atheism seriously appeals to the younger generation and it could be taken seriously. He says, if it becomes a popular movement in this day, then the church will need to raise its game and its quality of worship and the intellectual seriousness of its scholarship and preaching and its wider civic contribution. I'm preaching to the choir again. But it's vital that laity are soundly educated in how theology has changed and been reinterpreted down the centuries. Laity need to know that any question they ask has already been discussed by serious theologians, even if some of those answers have been marginalised along the way. And so to finish, as midwives to the creation of hospitable communities, each of us must be able to say what is in our hearts, the good and the bad. We need to confront when real issues are not allowed expression. We need to call a halt in discussions when third-person language never becomes first-person, or where anecdotes never give way to deeper experiences. We have to challenge when hard questions are dismissed with pious words, scolding, inadequate scriptural quotes, or are silenced by the big rod of creeds and confessions. We must love despite differences, something almost impossible to do. We are the fools who ask the questions that others are afraid to ask, who risk our status to free the tongues of others. In any era, it has been the outspoken and the outsiders that do the groundwork for change that may not even be established in their lifetime. As midwives of change creating hospitable communities, we have to be the leaven in the bread, the salt in the soup, and the light in the darkness when it comes to living with authenticity in our time and place. People like us are often in the minority or on the margins, but we crystallize our thinking on the perimeter such that when authorities are ready to embrace new thinking, the paperwork is done. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Val. We're going to take just a few minutes to take some of your questions. And the way we'll do this is we'll do it boy-girl or girl-boy, however we get started. And if you'll keep your question short and not have it be a big, long statement, but just make it a nice, quick question, Val can respond and we can get to more questions that way. So who has a question that they'd like to ask?
Hi, my name is Delia, and I have two comments. One of them will have a question. First of all, Your comments have been really inspirational. Thank you for being here with us today. Secondarily, I've always said to Christian friends of mine, as well as non-Christians, that God is so great that he delivers the right message to the right people in the right format. And that means it differs from one population to another. And so sometimes when I say, is your God so great that he can express that diversity as needed to diverse populations, and it causes them to pause. I don't know whether they actually answer yes, and so it's okay if you're Muslim or if you're Christian or if you're something else, because the message coming to you is from the divine and it's tailored to you. Secondarily, I've always felt a little bit that I've failed my kids because I have not imposed on them my own religious doctrine and beliefs. And so my son, who's 35, is Muslim. My daughter, who's 26, is Unitarian, the last time I checked. And my youngest daughter, Sedona, moves more towards Buddhism, but she actually has her own set of theological beliefs. Listening to the comments about being midwives of creation, I think, gives me a bit of joy to say I nurtured their spirit and gave them the ability to make choices for their own. And so I probably failed them in other ways, but I'm just glad that I was able to do that, and I just want to thank you for providing that framework of being midwives to the creation of a hospitable theology. And so I guess the question is, do people come to you and say, how do I grapple with family members who think differently? And so what do you advise them to do? Is it simply nurture the spirit within?
Well, thank you for that. I think it's turning theology upside down. It's starting from what we know, what we really know. And what we know is how to be a human being and how to be a better, and what we hope for is to be a better human being, rather than starting with sets of doctrines that have to be believed. And out of our growth as human beings, we can then reflect theologically, and that is what shapes our doctrines, be they ever changing and moving. And so if we concentrate on what we have in common as being human beings and be able to talk about that together, about our joys and our hopes and our pain, then I think that's anything theological can come out of that rather than the other way around. Doctrines that have to be believed always create borders. Quick story, a woman I had a retreat once said that her three children had become Hindu. They had this wonderful little thing they quoted when they walked every morning. So she said, I wrote my own mantra and I walk with them quoting mine at my Christian understanding of my beliefs. And she said, we have such a good time deciding which one God's going to listen to.
How about a guy? Is there a man with a question? Are there any women that have questions for their men? All right, Kurt.
My question, Val, is which of your books really deal with the topic as you addressed now in the last 15 minutes?
This is a more recent talk that I did, In terms of going across, for an introductory book, the Doubts book is best for people that just want to get into the swing of what I'm doing and get permission to doubt and see where that takes me. Like Catching Water in a Net, Human Attempts to Describe the Divine, and Stepping Out with the Sacred, Human Attempts to Engage the Divine, are two books that go right across religions. They're not just in one tradition. And that is basically saying how people have described the mystery of God in different religious situations and none. And then the next one is how people have tried to engage God or presence or whatever, again, across religions. So those two, I think, would be after the doubt one, because they're probably a little more, there's probably a lot more information in them. But if you want to look at interfaith dialogue or other religions, it's a great way to look at a great introduction to religions other than our own. And it's all taken from the idea of sharing what we have as human beings, what we share as human beings, and then looking in different chapters at things like mystery, at things like spirit, different images that have been used for God.
How about a woman with a question?
Well, I thought both of your presentations were just wonderful. I do have one question. If I heard it right, I think you said that we shouldn't listen through our own filter, and I'm not sure how you do anything but that.
Yes. Of course, that is certainly true. We are anything interpreted. But we've got to realize that it's also the Bible is interpreted by its authors. You know, any theology is interpreted by the theologian and what their particular desires are. Any theologian comes to the questions they ask from their own experience. Why did I write about doubt? Because that was my problem. Why does somebody else write about something different? As I said Thursday, Augustine wrote about sex because that was his problem. And so everyone forms their theology on reflection of their own problems. So yes, you are totally right that we all have our own agendas. What I was meaning was not to let that agenda dominate what you're listening to. I mean, we can listen to somebody and filter what they're saying according to whether we think they're right or wrong from our list of doctrines, or we can encourage someone to keep talking and talking. And a lot of the stories with interfaith dialogue is to try and step into the other religious tradition as best as we can, and then look back at our tradition and see if it has anything to show us. And that book, apart from Buddha, I Could No Longer Be Christian, is a wonderful example of that, because he's a Catholic scholar and his wife is ex-priest scholar and his wife is Buddhist. And he does this wonderful thing, especially for Catholics, of going into the Buddhist tradition, taking different doctrines, for example, you know, the doctrine of the Trinity, and then looking at how there might be some information or ways of thinking from somebody else's experiences that help us to better describe that experience in Christianity in the 21st century.
How about a guy with a question? All right, we'll go to a woman.
Thank you. I don't know if I'm going to say this correctly, but you appear from me, without knowing much about you, open to exploring other faiths, other people's beliefs. And you mentioned that you trained in the ELCA seminary. So you appear to be, without the use of a label, I'm being very vague,
That's right.
You appear to be drawn to Christianity. Have you ever explored somewhere else and been drawn there? And what is it about Christianity that you cling to and profess and hold dear?
Well, I have probably spent half my life trying to get out of Christianity because I had so many doubts, and that's what sent me back to theology. I was a microbiologist and then had an art gallery and then decided I couldn't live with my questions any longer. So I would go to the university and do religious studies, and if that meant I was going to walk away from God, so be it, that would happen. And so I'm going into religious studies, which was a secular university subject, not in a seminary. So I was able to ask my questions, and I always got into trouble because they said my Protestant petticoat was showing. And so it was a way of walking out of what we had to believe. I did my PhD in a Lutheran seminary.
Freudian slip.
Don't quote me.
Freudian petticoat.
But fortunately, the seminary in Minneapolis had about 80 staff from the world religion people right across to clones of Luther. And so I could find my way in amongst that. I was not tied to something. And that, well, I think that's where I got interested in world religions, which I also taught. And I guess it's a matter, as I said before, of seeing ourselves, who we are as human beings, and that's the only thing we have in common. I mean, you know, everyone who's travelled knows that you can sit on the step outside a shop in Peru and sit with a mother with a baby, and you can have a full conversation with that mother with a baby, even though you don't have their language, because there's something common about humanity if you've also been a mother with a baby. And so to try and find what it is about human beings, and if we can take... Certainly it needed a change into the progressive ideas of Jesus, of Christianity, of God, to be able to do that. But then working with other traditions means that I have new language that I can now use in my journey. Certainly not tightly held with the doctrines of the Uniting Church. I'm a bit of a problem for them. But being able to sort of start from that humanity and try and talk to other people on the levels of their humanity, not in the doctrinal way. The doctrines come up, of course, and if people are so much on the other end of the pole in terms of literal beliefs, we don't have much to say. In fact, it's harder to talk, I think, to a literal fundamentalist Christian than it is to talk to a Buddhist or a Hindu or anyone else, because our basis of believing literally the Bible is that we have nothing in common.
How about a guy? Because otherwise I'm going to take this question. You've spoken about the need for progressive communities to up their game as far as the quality of our civic engagement. You've traveled all over the world. Can you give an example or two of what you've seen as best practices in that area?
I think most progressives have realized that once we take Jesus as a wise sage who, in his time and place, brought a message of transformation, certainly in the social issues and along social lines, and because of that was killed for it. I mean, that is the strongest message for us to be socially engaged. We have so muddied the idea of the passion, death, resurrection story that it's become some cosmic drama with Jesus as the pawn in that drama, what had to be traded between God and the devil. All those sorts of things have come through in 20 centuries of theology. If we can go back to the Bible and read the sorts of things that were going on in Jesus' life, and also to read the context. That's another thing we haven't done. Because by the end of the first century, Judaism was seen not only as the enemy of what was emerging as Christianity, but also equated with Satan. It wasn't just the enemy. There was an equation there with Satan, or the evil one. And so obviously if you are creating doctrines out of something else, everything is going to be against Judaism. And then later when we get into the Greek understandings, where all our language changed into Greek sort of language, we get the divine saviour images coming in there. So there's a huge evolution in the first four centuries or five and six centuries of Christianity. But so if we can go back to what might have been the point of Jesus in his day, which involves learning about the context of that day, not saying, like I heard in one of the televangelists yesterday, you know, the Romans had problems with this just like we have problems with that. It's not that simple. We have to be able to know what was going on. But if we can look at Jesus as a social reformer, as somebody who was not afraid to do what he did, and as somebody who also died for it, and recover the magnitude of someone being willing to go to death on account of how strongly he felt about offering something new within Judaism, then I think we can be challenged more for that. Progressives, I think, are coming from that angle because they're coming from that new idea or that other idea of Jesus rather than as somebody who was God and knew everything. And so returning to Jesus, returning to the Bible to find that, is inspiring is a message for us today. And it's a message of social justice and radical social justice. And I don't think any of us will ever be as radical as we think we'd like to be, because we are so trapped in our own affluence, in our own capital culture, in all these things that just don't go along with the idea of caring for the poor. And I think the issue in the Bible too, I'm not even answering David's question, am I? Am I answering your question? I think we have to realise that in the ideas of the New Testament times, giving to the poor was not just walking down the street and handing a dollar to the homeless person. The poor was actually a class of people. And so Jesus' challenge is to try and remove the social structures that keep a whole group of people in poverty. So it's not just about handing out money, it's about working within the systems within our world that will actually change that class of poverty, which we're all quite happy to have because we benefit by it in our affluent societies. So I think that it becomes a political challenge, not just a challenge to build homelessness, or which is marvellous, wonderful. I love your homelessness program that you were talking about this morning. But it goes much, much further to see how we can make change. And I think that's the progressive call.
Do you have voice for one more question?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm actually going to follow up on David's question. What churches do you see that you show that shows the best practice of what you believe in? And do those churches celebrate a Sunday morning worship?
Well, I'll give you two examples from Australia. The first example is Peter Kennedy, who is a Catholic priest in Brisbane, Australia, has had a church with 1,000 people, which is enormous for Australia, has a huge homelessness program, is working with all areas of poverty in Brisbane. He decided that the rules of the church and the tradition of the church are not what the 21st century needs. He therefore began to do his own thing, which of course is a no-no in the Catholic Church. They left him alone so long as he didn't go above the radar. They had a few people then that took photos and sent it to Vatican. And the next thing, the Archbishop had to clamp down on him. And he and the other priest were excommunicated or told they could not preach anywhere in Australia again. And so on the last Sunday, he said to his congregation of 1,000, I'm now going to go down and we're going to have a community down in the Trades and Labour Council building, which was just down the road, the union building. He said, anyone wants to come with me, just come. 900 out of the 1,000 walked down behind him to form the new church because they knew he cared about them as a community. And even though the hierarchy had said that he was responsible to them, he cared about the community. So they are now doing the 5 years they've been down there now, and they're just blossoming because they're getting people from all over the city who aren't Catholic. They're just people who want to live in a way that's faithful living. So that's one example. What was my other example going to be? There are some churches that can do that, but you know, we're just in a bind. I mean, maybe it's going to sort out for us because churches are dying and we're going to get smaller and smaller and our buildings are going to be a problem. That's happening in Australia. I mean, we have churches with 5 people so then have to be sold or put to some other use. So I think probably it's going to happen to us rather than us doing it to ourselves, in which case we need to get off our chairs and work out what is the church about. Is it about buildings? Is it about institutions? You know, what is it about worship? And I know a lot of progressive churches won't use that word because it indicates sort of bowing down to the Almighty God upstairs. And it should be more about communities encouraging and sharing with each other. And my scientific conference, helping everybody in their particular journey to do it the best way they can. But I think it's the radical challenge that we really have to wake up and smell the coffee, that if we are going to be walking the way of Jesus, that was an incredibly radical, politically involved, poverty involved type of movement.
Thank you very much. Let's show our appreciation to that.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.